Today's talk is given by Professor Phil Townsend of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His talk is entitled Spectroscopic Remote Sensing of Vegetation. The subtitle reveals much about plant chemistry, physiology, and ecosystems, and even more about what we don't know. Phil is Professor of Remote Sensing, Spatial Analysis and Ecology at Wisconsin-Madison, where his research and teaching focus on remote sensing of ecosystems, reflectance spectroscopy, and imaging spectroscopy. His work makes use of many forms of remote sensing, including multispectral, hyperspectral, radar, and LIDAR, from various platforms, such as contact measurements, sensors, cameras, drones, aircraft, and satellites, the whole spectrum. Recent efforts focus specifically on linking spectral measurements to plant genetic and physiological information to advance the capacity for the measurement of biochemistry and plant function. And after studies at the University of Virginia and University of North Carolina, Phil was assistant and associate professor of remote sensing and landscape ecology at the University of Maryland from 1998 to 2005. He joined the faculty of the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 2005 as an associate and now full professor. Therefore, with a wealth of experience and of a huge range of sensors, bandwidths and techniques, amongst other things, we look forward to a very interesting talk on all things remote sensing. Phil.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm glad to be here, and I want to, in particular, just make it clear that this is a consortium talk. There's a bunch of other names here, and then even more names on the last slide, and I do want to pay particular compliments to Clayton Kingman, who's with me here on this trip. He's one of our researchers in my lab who's been instrumental to a lot of this work, but none of this work is singular to me. It's all a large group of people who participate. Most of you are students, right? Are almost all of you students who are in here? A few of you are not. One of the things that I want to just lay out front here is that what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a presentation that's going to be a series of vignettes. And if I start running out of time, I can just start ratcheting. I can turn off some of these vignettes. But it's actually what the studies that I'm showing you about here are risks that I took in my research. And the idea in my research, in my research group, is we look at those things that we think we need to know more about, or we need to map them. And we look at first principles, we look at empirical literature, we look at a lot of data at a lot of variety of levels, and we say, well, there seems to be things out there that would suggest that we should be able to do this, and in particular, the tool that I use. I don't know if this is a metaphor here, but we have this metaphor of that you have a hammer and you're going around looking for different nails, and the hammer is spectroscopy or imaging spectroscopy or remote sensing. And part of why I've been able to be successful and why and the sorts of things that I'm going to show you are things that weren't necessarily the off-the-shelf methods that we were looking at trying to use for remote sensing, but were more things that said, well, this could possibly be the case. Let's try it out and let's see what works. And I'm fortunate to be able to put myself in the position of showing you the things that works. All the things that didn't work, I'm not going to talk about. We'll forget about those for now. But so I'm interested. I'm an ecologist and a geographer, and I'm interested in the physiology of plants. I'm interested in carbon dioxide uptake. I'm interested in the function of plants. I'll spend a teeny bit of time talking about methods, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about methods. I'm going to spend more time talking about how we've been able to use the different types of methods that I'm going to describe to actually get new information and actually understand something about what's going on with plants and vegetation. And I'd like to start off with these two statements. I really see the work that I'm doing, and I see the possibility of spectroscopy as being able to measure, and I actually do mean measure, the heartbeat and lung capacity of ecosystems. So the spectral measurements allow you to characterize traits, that's a term that we use a lot in ecology, that are important to understanding how vegetation functions at all levels, from an individual plant to global ecosystems. And I use the word measure because I'll be showing you some things where we're going to turn our spectral measurements into something that they're not, like chemical composition. But even so, the spectral measurement of a plant, in and of itself is something that's really interesting to us. And the variation in those spectrum measurements tell us a lot that that we can use and that we can then use to infer properties of ecosystems. And they also, interestingly enough, tell us a lot that we don't know that provide us the basis for future work. So really quickly, when I talk about vegetation and I talk about this heartbeat and ecosystem, I'm actually talking about a heartbeat and lung capacity. I'm actually talking about two things. One, which is sort of a process, which would be heartbeat, and that really has to deal with photosynthesis. In a minute, I'll have a couple slides where I'll give little bits of lessons on photosynthesis, but basically what happens when light hits a leaf is there's essentially three things happen. The light is absorbed, transmitted, or reflected, and the light that actually is used by the plant has three things that can happen to it. It can be dissipated through a process called non-photochemical quenching. It can be fluoresced. Under different circumstances, the plants will actually emit a certain amount of light to relieve some of the biochemical pressure. But a lot of that light gets used in a process called photochemistry. It sets into process a number of factors that actually drive our planet. Lung capacity has more to do with the chemical composition of plants. And those of you who were out last weekend making measurements will know that the different structure of a canopy as well as of a leaf, everything that's in there will affect the measurement that you have. And I've just shown a variety of different things. I've got chlorophyll here. I've got rubisco, which is the primary enzyme responsible for catalyzing carbon dioxide uptake, different structures of leaves, and this is lignin. All of these will affect what your spectral measurement of a plant will be. And I think I'm probably telling you something that you know. These are just a couple of spectral images of some agricultural fields, a true color and a false color. And, you know, this is a spectrum of different types of reflectance features. These don't come from this field. One is of a conifer and one is of a broadleaf. And your visible spectrum might be looking at these wavelengths. Your color infrared spectrum might be interested in looking at these wavelengths. But what I'm actually interested in, what I do, is I look at the full spectrum. And I've just got several different plants here that are agricultural plants that we study. I'm going to talk a lot about applications today. And if you go into the literature, you can find all sorts of characteristic wavelengths that people have studied in depth, particularly at the leaf level, where there are particular absorption features associated with different things that we might be interested in. Certainly chlorophyll, plants are green, and the absorption, slightly higher reflectance in the green and absorption in the red and blue is what makes plants look green. But there are also well-known features associated with nitrogen content, maybe a little bit less well-known features associated with things like phenolics that are used by plants for defenses. But there's a heavy literature on this, and these are methods, spectrometers, big benchtop spectrometers, that people in plant sciences have been using for decades in order to estimate chemical composition. What we want to do is take this out in the field and then eventually turn this into something that we might be able to map using spectrometers or imaging spectrometers that you would place on any number of different types of platforms. And again, you can delve into the physics quite a bit, but a molecule in a leaf is not a fixed thing. There are bonds within the molecules. These bonds have different types of different frequencies, bending, twisting, stretching, a lot of other types of factors that will affect that in combination with the wavelength, the frequency of the light, will create absorption, reflection, and so forth. So just a little bit more background to the sorts of things that I do. I'm interested in both in spectrometry at all scales, and I'll have a little bit at the end about the importance of using all of these different scales. So I am actually going to be talking about leaf level spectroscopy, where you might make one measurement of a plant under certain conditions. And this is soybeans. These are all soybean plants that are being grown together but have different levels of stress applied to them. These are measurements that might have been taken using an ASD spectrometer. And this is not advertisement for ASD. There are lots of spectrometers out there, and we might use them. Or you might have imaging spectroscopy, where each pixel is the same type of measurement that each measurement that might have been made with the leaf here. And in this case, this is an area in the mountains, the Appalachian Mountains in the eastern U.S., where there are pixels of disturbed versus healthy forest. every single pixel has something like this, and it creates a lot of data. In addition, to be able to do these things, again, I'm talking about the heartbeat and lung capacity of ecosystems, you can't just actually go out into the ecosystem and do this. And so the type of research that I'm going to show you is going to involve measurements at all different types of scale. It might be above canopy. I don't know if you guys have something similar to OSHA, which is Occupational Safe Hazards Administration in the U.S. And I had a guy in the audience one time and said, well, that's not OSHA approved, standing up on a ladder, hanging out there with your, that's a different type of spectrometer there. But we'll make measurements at the leaf level, at the canopy level. We'll make them in fields. You can't really see this very well, but this is actually a design setup with a bunch of different types of manipulations to both native and agricultural crops. It's a biofuels experiment, or we work in the greenhouse. And actually, I'll show you some results from this particular greenhouse experiment as well. And why do we do this? We do it because we don't want to have to do a lot of this, this, and this. This measurement, this instrument right here, is an LI6400. It's an infrared gas analyzer. It's what we use, it's what the majority of the world uses to measure photosynthesis, to get photosynthetic parameters that we're interested in using. It's a persnickety instrument. It takes a lot of time to make the measurement. It's not easy to move around. Boy, wouldn't it be nice if we could make a light measurement off a leaf or a spectral measurement from imagery to be able to do this. To get at chemistry or a lot of other factors, we have to take samples back to the lab, process them, run them through a machine that costs money, costs time, costs effort. If we can do this and get what we want, which would eventually be a map such as this, then we're golden. And I have this in here. These are actually from an airborne imaging spectrometer, a spectral measurement of the canopy and a spectral measurement of the leaf of the exact same place. And I use this sometimes to also say one of the grand challenges that we face is reconciling the fact that these don't all look the same. But I'm not going to spend any time on that. So that's not really the interesting stuff. The big idea, and this comes from a proposal that Janine Cavender-Barris at the University of Minnesota, John Gammon, and myself wrote, is that optical measurements provide surrogates for the things that we're really interested in. And to some extent, if we're interested in albedo or reflectance, we make direct measurements. There are other things that we might be able to directly retrieve. But they provide information, whether it be about diversity, which is shown here, but about the function of vegetation, which is easy to measure, easy to characterize, it's digital, it's a record, that might actually be related to everything that's going on with the plant. So for example, we link this to soil properties. What's going on in the soils affects, we can't measure the soils from some spectral measurement way up here, unless if there's vegetation in between, but how the vegetation is responding to the soils is a signal that's burned into that leaf. That measurement of the leaf. And the same thing happens with the, so that's microbial diversity, but the same thing is true of the genetic diversity. What's going on genetically within the plant as it responds to its environment is part of the measurement. So in some respects, you can actually think of the spectral measurements as being the same or similar, of a similar depth of information as say, a genome. Okay. So, like I said, I'm going to do a series of vignettes, which are right here, and this is kind of a menu of things, and I can kind of skip things if needed, but I'm going to just take a couple minutes to go through methods. There'll be one place later in the talk where I'll talk about methods again, but I want to just kind of give you a sense of how we get to the things that we do in my group. Our ultimate goal might be, for a project, if we're talking about traits, measuring foliar traits, is a map of foliar traits, and I'll show you this map later. There's a lot of data that goes into this. We have work that happens at the leaf level. We make spectral measurements at the leaf level. We also make chemical measurements at the leaf level. We link those together to see if we can derive chemistry from spectra. We have image data that we go out and collect, and we have to do a lot of stuff to it, BRDF correction, atmospheric correction, a lot of work to that data. So we've got an image, we've got measurements from that same image that are related to the chemistry. We make a whole bunch of plot-based measurements of the structure of the vegetation, the composition of the vegetation, et cetera, that we scale then to something that would be the size of a pixel. Then we use a variety of methods to build the model. And we test a couple of different methods in my lab. We actually work primarily with empirical models, and I'll talk about that in a second. But we also test physically based models too. My group is very application practically oriented, and we're interested in making maps that people can use. And empirical approaches for us turn out to be able to be something that we can validate easily and make them be usable. And I just want to show you just that. That's for, say, traits. For physiology, this is that same infrared gas analyzer. We do the same thing, field measurements. In the case of physiology, we might make measurements, again, from a hyperspectral sensor, but this is also a thermal sensor. Photosynthesis is a chemical reaction. It's a series of chemical reactions, and therefore temperature is important to it. So if you know something about the temperature, the skin temperature of the vegetation you're measuring, not air temperature, temperature of the vegetation, you know something about what's going on. And ultimately, our interest is in global applications, which is to say, how much carbon dioxide is vegetation or ecosystems taking up, and what does that mean for the planet? How does that change under different types of circumstances? So we might make some sort of estimates from our field measurements in this, but we want to look at something that's perhaps more relevant. And so we actually link to flux towers, which are, there's one right here, which you can see here, that make measurements of gas exchange at the canopy level from which we can infer what's going on at a larger scale than, say, just a leaf. You can only measure photosynthesis at the scale of a leaf. The methods that I'm going to talk about today, and there's actually about half dozen different types of statistical methods that we use, and I'm not going to go into any of those. But the general approach to statistics that we do in my group is I think it's pretty rigorous, but it's got a general flow that I'd just like to share with you. So this is actually, let's just say these are all of our data points that we measured. It could be chemistry, it could be structure, it could be photosynthesis, it could be photosynthetic capacity. We collect all this data and we have all of these measurements. We do not use all of the data. We generally might use about a quarter of the data, which we would sample randomly from our data set. And we would do this many times. So these are different subsets of the data. Maybe as much as 1,000 times. We sample on all of the analysis. There's a lot of data collection. There's leaf level data, there's plot level data, there's image data, there's processing, that's images, there are multiple pixels that might be associated with this. Every time we sample our data, we sample it multiple times. That actually allows us to provide uncertainty estimates. And what I'm showing you here is observed versus predicted for some set of analyses that we do, right, that we've done from our analyses. And the key point that I want to show you is that by first of all, only using 25% of our data for building a model, using 75% to test it, and doing that 1,000 times, resampling our data, allows us to do this, which is to have error bars. And actually, when you're working with imagery, if you have this, you can actually apply all 1,000 of those models and build a pixel-by-pixel error map. And I'm going to show you some of those error maps. The thing that's really key about this is there's actually error bars in both directions. This is the predicted. The error bars are higher because it's an empirical model and our models aren't perfect. Actually, our measurement error, there are, you can probably see one if you squint enough there, but our actual measurement errors that we have for our observed data are actually considerably lower. And this is realistic. You can measure it better in person probably than you can from imagery, but we know both these pieces of information. So I'm going to show that, an example of that, with these vegetation traits mapping. So this is, again, we've got all these different types of traits we might want to measure. Chlorophyll's been done a lot, nitrogen's been done some, and there are these other things that are in here. That's electron transport right there. So these images that I'm showing you are from some work in the US. We use Avris, which is a hyperspectral imager that NASA has. It flies at a very high altitude and on U2, 65,000 feet, 20,000 kilometers, and these are a variety of sun study sites. We have about 160 images collected over 4 years. The idea was to try not just to do one-off study, but was to use study sites from all over the country in lots of different ecosystem types to be able to test whether we could build generalizable methods. And most of the images that I'm going to show you are actually from this site right here, which is in the Appalachian Mountains. It's kind of a neat place because this is the Appalachian Plateau up here, which is cool and wet. In fact, you'll see some vegetation in places like that that might remind you of Scotland. And then this site right here is a little bit to the east of it. It's in a rain shadow. It's very warm and dry. They have very different ecosystem properties in a very short area. And this is an example of the type of map that we would build. So this is, looking at this site, this is actually the Potomac River. These are ridges and mountains, and you can see this is nitrogen concentration. Nitrogen is the big driver of ecosystem processes, and we don't know the spatial variation in nitrogen. If we can make maps of nitrogen concentration, we can actually understand vegetation growth properties. This is something people who are ecosystem modelers really need to have. But this is all right. We've published stuff like this before. But this is the map that's really cool. This is the map of the error in that, based on our subsampling techniques. So this is a standard deviation of nitrogen. We can actually go and look now. We can provide to modelers who want maps like this, we can provide them this information that they can use to constrain their models. And this is something that modelers need to be able to better understand. So there's two things that have happened here. One is, in an ecosystem model, there might be one value for nitrogen concentration that they use. Now we can look at the spatial variability, and you can see there's a fair amount of spatial variability there. And two, we can give them an error assessment that is spatially explicit that they use. So this is just another variable. This is leaf mass per area, which is associated with the allocation of resources by plants. And then there's a whole suite of them. Nitrogen, leaf mass per area, lignin, fiber, carbon, cellulose, there are others, chlorophyll content, things like that, and we can see the error rate. So for example, cellulose might actually have a higher error rate, carbon, percent carbon might have a higher error rate as well, but these now give us information that we can use, they're validated, and we have maps that go along with them. Why is this important? So this is just showing three of the different study areas. This just has three of the anything that's not forest is masked out, is just white in these images. This has got nitrogen leaf mass per area, which is this allocation of resources, thick versus thin leaves. You can think of thick leaves allocate more resources towards longevity, thin leaves allocate more towards photosynthesis. And so these are shown in three different bands. All this is showing is the variation that you see there. So nitrogen, LMA, lignin, which is structure. These are the land cover maps, the NLCD, National Land Cover Database, that the US generates that people generally use for large scale modeling. These are those maps of this area. They don't show any level of variability that you have there. This is just the same thing from another area. This is a place called Devil's Lake. This is the land cover map. This is the trait map. This is what you would see on Google Earth. This is a fall image, so when the leaves are changing color, so if you get a fall image at the right time and really enhance it a lot, you might be able to see some of the variability. The point is that we're getting information content that we weren't getting out of sort of other traditional methods. This gives us the opportunity, and this is just shown by latitude here, to look at how these traits vary. And this is from all of those 160 images. A lot of data has been averaged, but there's a movement in ecology to look at global distribution of plant traits and what they mean for ecosystem function across the globe, and we can put our data into that context. So that's chemistry. That's the lung capacity, if you will. Physiology is more the heartbeat, and that's really more along the lines of what I'm interested in looking at. So we measure photosynthesis, we might measure it at the leaf level, but what we're really interested in is what's shown right here, which is the total carbon dioxide uptake, and then off as well you have respiration to sort of to balance what's going on in ecosystems. We've done this work in a number of places, but the work that the answers that I'm going to show you right here are from work that's in California. NASA's planes are based out of the Los Angeles area, and so they really, really encourage researchers who are funded by NASA to work in California. And right now, what they're trying to build motivation for a global scale Landsat type hyperspectral imager. And what they're doing is they're imaging as much of California as you can. It takes a long time to do all of this. This is a big state. At multiple times during the season to be able to demonstrate our ability to collect measurements and use more than just one-off hyperspectral image acquisitions. And this is just showing you, California is very diverse ecologically. What this is showing you is this is the global range of precipitation versus mean annual temperature, and the sites that we're using in California to cover a great range. So, you know, we have desert, we have high elevation forests, oak savannas, just a lot of different vegetation types. In this case, what we're interested in doing is going from some measurement of photosynthesis to some measurement of a trait. Measuring, what we really want to do is go from spectra to this, not from this, which takes a long time. We want that. So, VC max. So what we want to do is make measurements of VC max and J max. And now you say, what? How many of you have heard of VC max and J max? Ha! One of you, two of you. Well, Clayton, of course. So what are these? VC max and J max are two terms that are used in ecosystem model. Every ecosystem model that uses enzyme kinetics, which is basically the basic process of photosynthesis. There are light use efficiency models, there are enzyme kinetic models. Enzyme kinetic models are based on the chemistry of photosynthesis. Every single model that's used for global change models and everything needs these two terms. And they are hard to get, they take a lot of time, they're sparse in their distribution. If we can map it, we'll be much better off in our ability to constrain the performance of these models. What makes us think we can map these? Well, there's a literature out there that suggests that some of it is from John Gammon and a former colleague of mine, Kat Stalinsky, and then there's a fair amount of the work that's shown that we can do this that's come out of my group. Sean Servin is a former graduate student of mine, as well as other people that we've worked at. This is still work that's in process. So we want to get VC max. We make these measurements. So this is the other methods part. We make these measurements at different temperatures because these two measurements, which is, I should just say, these are capacity measurements. These aren't actual photosynthesis. It's the capacity of vegetation. This is the capacity of vegetation to perform photosynthesis under Rubisco limitation. This is the capacity of vegetation to perform photosynthesis under a limitation of electron transport. Think of this as the part of photosynthesis that's the light reactions. This is the light independent reaction. So this is really closely associated with all of the things associated with light use by plants. We make measurements with spectrometers. Actually, we make measurements with spectrometers concurrent with these measurements, but then we can measure a whole lot more of these, dozens, in the same time we can make these measurements. We can also make them from the canopy and from the leaf. We can use our method of choice and estimate this parameter right here from the spectra, and we can get a relationship. The key point that I'm trying to bring up here, Alistair, this is for you, is that actually when we look at these relationships, there is not a broadleaf and a needle leaf. So this structure affects spectra. We know it. We know it's a confounding error, but we've actually found that we can mix our data together and bring them together, and they work, and look. It's not like all of the broad leaves are up here and all the needle leaves are down there, which you might expect due to the effects of structure. We can then apply this to all of our data. We build a table. We then get our temperature maps, which we get from thermal imager, which allows us to put these in context of what their temperature is, because across a landscape, you might have vegetation at different temperatures. So that's where we use this term that was over there. This is the temperature dependency of photosynthesis. EV is what it's called. So I'm giving you photosynthesis. It's not photosynthesis 101. It's more like photosynthesis 501 here. Then we have our hyperspectral image. We apply these equations to it, and we end up getting a map of the trait. And we do this 1,000 times, just like I showed you with our sampling, so that we can actually get the error maps. And I'm not going to show you the error maps, but what I am going to show you here are two different VC max images. This is from a coastal sage. So this is a chaparral ecosystem in California. It's called Loma Ridge. These are two flux towers that are there, and I'll show you a little bit from these flux towers a little bit later. These are a month apart, and there's a variety of different things going on. This is VC max, from low being the greener colors to high being the oranger color. It's a coastal sage ecosystem. The coastal sage itself is most active at this time point, generally, because it's wetter earlier in the year. California's vegetation typically typically dormant or largely dormant in the summer. But in this particular location, there's a lot of deciduous tree species, oaks mainly. And between this state and this state, the oaks greened up. So that's an inherent property that's in the vegetation. And we actually see some differences that we would have expected from our other data sources. How do we evaluate our maps that we have there? So again, we're actually, the pixel is not really very representative of the leaf, because there's a lot of leaves, there's a lot of different species that are present. What the pixel is representative of is a full canopy. So this is our leaf measurement that's shown. This is the tower at the same location. Right there is Eric Kruger, who's the physiologist who I work with. And our basic approach is that we can take data from an eddy covariance tower, which is measuring gas exchange at the canopy level. Here we're measuring gas exchange at the leaf level, and we basically compare them at the pixel level. Turns out that actually didn't work so well, it didn't work so well not because of us, but because of the way the tower data are. So we actually have to turn our gas exchange data into the same measurements that you get from the flux tower. So rather than turning the flux tower into our measurements, we have to turn our measurements into the flux tower. And this is just an example of the sort of result that you would have. So this is VC max estimated from the adverse imagery. This is VC max. So this is photosynthetic potential. This is the VC max estimated from gas exchange. And this is VC max estimated from the tower. This was the middle of a drought, and so the tower didn't handle drought very well. But the key point is that what we have now is a lot of data. NASA has flown these aircraft missions over these sites for 2 years now during each season. These are all of the flux towers that we're working with in California. Each one of these dotted lines are the different times that the plane has flown over each one of these. Each one of these lines is GPP, gross primary productivity, daily mean gross primary productivity. And this is just for 2013. Each time there's a line crossing this, you actually have a data point. So lots of images, lots of flux tower data points. We have our model that we apply to estimate photosynthetic capacity, and that's where the comparison. This is the coastal sagebrush that I showed you. The point here is that we have a wide range of GPP, and if you notice this, we've got oak pine, woodland, ponderosa pine, mixed conifer, sagebrush, grassland, desert chaparral, pinyon juniper, and what I don't have shown on here are all the agricultural sites, your pistachios, your almonds, a lot of the food that you eat in the winter comes from California. And I eat in winter. I live in a pretty northerly place. Okay, so this is a graph that my student, or our student on this project, just sent me this morning, in fact. This is GPP. This is what we're all interested in, gross primary productivity. This is wavelength, and he didn't know what the band, but here we've got shortwave infrared, here we've got the visible, here we've got the near infrared. This is the correlation coefficient. So he's gone and estimated GPP at different time points. So 2 week max, so it looks at a 2 week period around the time of the flight, or the 30 minutes before the flight, during the flight, or after the flight. This is for all of those flux towers that I showed you on the last page, for all of the times that the plane flew over. So your N might be 60 or 70 observations, and this is just for 2013. So notice here that the correlation is negative. So actually, this is good. This is a high correlation by wavelength. This black one here is 2 week max. And what you're seeing is these really, really high correlations across all these different ecosystems with GPP. And this is what we had hoped to see and what we would expect. What we really like out of this is it's these wavelengths up here, which are not typically the wavelengths that a lot of people think about using. These are shortwave infrared wavelengths, have very, very strong relationships with GPP. This is where we know that biochemistry is expressed, okay? It's not where chlorophyll is expressed. It's also where water content is expressed very strongly in foliage. So we actually have a physiological reason why this works, and this is where research comes into play. The near infrared, which is what you typically think of with pulse color infrared, not correlated at all. And that's actually where structure is expressed. So very good, that's what we would hope. And this is actually just showing you these correlations. So this is maximum GPP versus the SWIR2 for Chris and Alistair and Clayton. So you see a correlation of negative 0.79. So higher GPP, lower reflectance in the shortwave infrared. This is what we would expect. This is really promising. And this was just work that my student Sean Boyes did yesterday. PRI, any of you guys know what PRI is? Photochemical Reflectance Index. No correlation. That's worthwhile at all. So we want to use this information, and I'm just going to show you just some real quick agricultural applications. Disease, this is potato virus Y. This is an undergraduate student who works in my lab. These are potato plants, a lot of potatoes grown in Wisconsin. It affects the physiology of plants, and we see significant differences. This is the outcome of a statistical analysis of different affected and non-affected plants, and it's translating the high-dimensional spectral data at the leaf and canopy level to just a few dimensions. Basically, we can really distinguish the difference before we can distinguish them visually, and this is due to the physiological effects of potato virus Y. There's some effect, and there's not much effect in the visible area. There's a little bit in the near infrared, but where actually the most important effects for separating these out turned out to be in these areas of the shortwave infrared, which is not something that people have exploited in remote sensing, particularly in agricultural applications. We did the same thing with tobacco. Tobacco is actually a test plant that we use. We're not really interested in tobacco as a crop, but a lot of work has been done on the genetics of tobacco. We have access to strains of tobacco that have very low pigments and things like that that we can use. And likewise, I'd like to show this one here. So right here we have spectra from different varieties of corn, and here the color of this is meant to align with the color of each of these. And actually, if each of these look the same to you, they look the same to me because it's the same picture. It's not really each one of those, but if you go out in the field, I can't tell the difference between it. The geneticist can, and the chemical composition of the plants are different. We can actually see that in the spectra. The neatest application that we've had of this to date, one of that we've actually published, so a lot of this is stuff that's in progress, is this work that John Couture, who's a postdoc in my lab, has done. He's a chemical ecologist, and he's really interested in understanding broad-scale variations in chemistry and plant response, but he's really interested in how it affects insects. And insects are really important, both beneficial and non-beneficial insects, but they're important as pollinators. But they're also important if there's something like this, which is the monarch butterfly. And, you know, this is a charismatic species. Monarch butterfly, they all overwinter on one small mountain range in Mexico. And this is where deforestation and land use is a really big issue. But they spread out all over North America. And it's kind of a keystone species that we see in our landscape, and it takes generations. So the monarchs that may migrate north, it may take them several generations to get back. They find their way back, and they find their way back to this one place. It's a really neat species if you're not familiar with it. Monarchs feed on one species. They feed on milkweed. Well, they don't just feed on milkweed, but they primarily feed on milkweed. Milkweed produces toxins. And here you see a bird, you can't really see it, but it's a bird upchucking a monarch butterfly that it's eaten because the monarch has consumed the milkweed has the toxins. And the toxins are basically just trying to keep the monarch larvae from feeding, but also to keep other animals, from herbivores, from grazing on them as well. And they are the chemicals, which are carbenolides, are initiated. Carbenolide production is initiated by feeding. So when a plant gets perturbed, it starts producing carbenolides, which then are brought into the leaf, which the monarch consumes. Other animals will consume them, and they'll get sick and spit it out. They won't eat it. So this is a pretty complex set of interactions that occur. To do a study, there's a variety of studies one might do, but to do a study of the chemistry of milkweed and to see how it generates these toxins, what one would have to do is perturb a leaf. We use a hole punch. It'll start, which would be like an herbivore eating it. That'll start the chemistry changing. Then we have to sample the leaf, take the leaf and do the chemistry. We have another one that we've done the same thing at the same time. We leave it, and we say, well, this is the same as this. This one, we got the chemistry of what's happened. And we keep doing that. Any type of study requires a large number of samples and some assumptions about your data as you try to understand how the chemistry changes with time. We don't really want to do that. What we would really like to be able to do is track how the chemistry is changing in real time, and then we can actually design experiments where we can go and perturb climate, for example. And that's one of the big questions, is how is climate change going to affect this charismatic species? So we decided to use spectra. The story is actually right here on this slide. And this is spectra of milkweed right here. But what John did is he set up an experiment where he basically perturbed milkweed, made chemical measurements of the milkweed, and at different times after the perturbation, we measured spectra, so this would be 15 minutes, an hour, 24 hours, and so forth. These are spectra of different, these are the differences in the spectra, which is seen here, and the spectra at each one of these different times. So this is actually a difference, and what you see is there are big changes in spectra of the leaf, and you just do a hole punch on it. At the same time, he went and he took chemistry of another sample, set of samples that he's doing this at the same time to be able to use the spectra to see if he could actually predict carbenolide concentration. We put our spectrometer up to the leaf. We get a spectrum. We estimate how much carbenolides are there. Then we want to know, does this change with climate change or temperature or anything like that? The only point of showing this one here, this slide right here, is that these are showing the sort of the weightings of our predictive model. But we also made measurements of digitoxin, which is the black right here, which is a very closely related standard chemical material that has a similar chemical structure to carbenolides. And basically, we found the places that were important for our predictive model also lined up with absorption features that we know occur in digitoxin. So we think we're actually measuring something that's real. This then allowed us, that's showing right there, this then allowed us to go and do this laboratory experiment where we could then go and change climate, change temperature regimes. Can't see it, 25 degree, 18 degree, up to 30, 23 degree, and also drought stress, and identify what the effects were on caterpillar performance. And interestingly enough, we did this across different genetic populations of the caterpillars as well. And actually, interestingly enough, the monarchs appear to be benefited by climate change. But what they're not benefited by are land use change. And so as the land use affects their habitat, and you lose the appropriate land uses, they are not benefiting that. So it turns out that land use change is the stronger effect on them. We actually did find a negative effect of drought, and that is important because, at least in the U.S., this is the big change that's going to happen. We're going to have more extreme climates. A lot more really wet periods, a lot more really dry periods, and drought is not a good thing. Genetics. This is a study. These are our sites. There's some in the Rocky Mountains. These are the sites in the upper Midwest of the U.S. This is Lake Superior right here. This is Wisconsin. I live there. Aspen is a clonal species. It's probably, it, it's In North America, it's probably the most important species, probably the most important species in Europe as well. It's certainly the most widespread. It's very important for economic purposes. It's a clonal species, so when you see a patch of aspen, like you see right there, that's actually multiple ramets of the same genus. This is all one organism. In this case right here, this is the largest organism on our planet because it is actually one organism together, multiple ramets of the same genus, and its mass is enormous. Aspen is really neat. These are all aspens right here. If you have imagery at the right time, phenological imagery, you can actually see different genotypes of aspen on the landscape because they all turn color at the same time, and that's shown right here. But we can't always get imagery at the right time. My collaborators, and Clayton's been central to this one as well, my collaborators, Mike Madrich and Rick Lindroth at the University of Wisconsin, have written a number of papers where they've shown that these different genotypes of aspen also have very strongly different chemical profiles, and their soil microbial communities are completely different. So we asked the question, if we can detect chemistry, and this is different genotypes of aspen in this one area of Utah right here, and this is a highly enhanced Averis hyperspectral image right here. This is the site. This is actually the Pando clone right here, which is the world's largest organism that I just talked about. They have different amounts of tannins, nitrogen, and there are other chemistries that we measure as well. We can actually distinguish genotypes based on their chemistries. We can actually also distinguish genotypes based on their soil microbes. The question is, can we distinguish genotypes based on their spectral profile? The answer to that was an emphatic yes. And this isn't showing up very well, but we could ask the question, are spectral traits related to foliar traits? Are spectral traits related to soil traits? Are foliar traits related to soil traits? And are spectral traits related to soil traits? So we can't map the soils from this, but we can see if what we're seeing in the spectra is actually related to things that we know between different genotypes of aspen are different. And as it turns out, so this is spectra, this is foliar, this is soils. It actually turns out that we can predict the differences in foliar traits pretty well. The foliar traits do an okay job predicting the soil traits, and the foliar traits do a very good job of predicting the differences in soil traits. So I'm going to just tell you what the story is in plain English here. We can better detect differences between genotypes of aspen using the spectral data than we can using foliar data or soil data. And we can actually better distinguish differences in the soils using the spectral data because of the measurement of the vegetation that we're making here. Why is this? One is it's related to the different chemistries. But you know what? When we make these measurements of chemistry, we can't measure all the chemistries. We don't even know all the chemistries that are important, that are different. But that spectral profile, it's a record of the differences that are there. It actually will help point us towards the things that we need to look to see why they're different. The other part to it is that we did a genetic, we know the genetic information about these different genotypes. We did an analysis. Is genetic difference related to optical difference? So as something becomes more genetically, as genotypes become more genetically dissimilar from each other, do they become more spectrally dissimilar from each other? And that was the biggest difference that we would find there. The answer is the more genetically dissimilar, the more optically dissimilar. We're really pushing this right now, and one of the places where we're working on this is using hyperspectral imagery at places with very well-known genomes. And this is an orchard at University of California, Riverside, where they've got hundreds of varieties of citrus trees. It's a very well-known phylogeny that's separated them out into Valencia oranges, sweet oranges, blood oranges, whatever. I've just clipped out a bit of it. So we basically tried to see if we could build a spectral phylogeny and compare that to the actual phylogeny. And all that really matters to look here is that when you classify this out, all by spectral data, this is a spectral phylogeny, all the sweet oranges go together. All the navel oranges go together. Everything like this. So they're sorting out. You go out into these fields, you couldn't tell the difference between these. If you see a fruit, you might be able to tell the difference. But the foliage is different. Okay, so my last vignette, running out of time. But I got my last vignette here. So scaling. Oh! I have one more. Sorry. Actually, this is the thing that's really cool that we're doing right now. And this I put in the category of something that we need to learn and understand. But this is getting back to soils again. So compounds, molecules that are in the environment, atoms, they're not all exactly the same. They have different isotopes. They have different numbers of electrons. And nitrogen, in particular, has a variety of different forms, N15, N14. And so N15 is a heavier nitrogen. Plants actually differentially take up these different isotopes of nitrogen at different rates. And the movement of nutrients from the soil to a plant is mediated by microbes that actually allow this movement to occur. And these are called mycorrhizae. And the mycorrhizae, there are a variety of different types of mycorrhizae, and the mycorrhizae have preferences for different isotopes, nitrogen, carbon, oxygen. It's just a fascinating sort of thing. There were a number of papers a few years ago that showed that spectral data was sensitive to the isotope concentrations of nitrogen. We're not measuring different isotopes of nitrogen. We're measuring something else that's in there. We'd like to know what it is, and we're trying to figure it out. But there was a very strong relationship that was there. I am showing you a site. This is, again, from the Appalachians. This is this area that I showed you before. This is nitrogen concentration. This is actually isotopic nitrogen concentration that was built from models using the same types of models that I showed before. I did not show this map before. There's been some suggestion that our ability to map isotopic nitrogen is related to our ability to map nitrogen. If there's more nitrogen, there's more N15. What you're seeing here, if you look along this ridge right here, and I can show you many examples of this, you can see huge differences in isotopic nitrogen, even though the nitrogen doesn't vary very much either. And actually, I'll just point out to you right now that there are some there's some variation in this area that's of interest too. And that's just based on having seen Ian Woodhouse's talk yesterday. So just point out these areas right here. So we started to wonder, why is this? I mean, we've got leaf-level measurements that confirm that this is true, but why are these differences? You go out here, you look at the maps, you look at the images, you don't see much. Here's just an example. Again, the light's not great, but this is Google Earth. You know, this area right here, you see forests, you see this. But if you go back, the history function in Google Earth is wonderful. You go back to 1992, and you see that these areas right here were logged. These forests grow back pretty quickly. This is a pretty temperate area of the world. These are now 20-something-year-old forests, probably 25, 30-year-old forests. So they're not big forests, but they're forests. Look back here, you know, it all looks like continuous forest, and you see it. And what we realized that we were seeing is these differences due to the land use legacy. And you know what? The interpretation of differential uptake of nitrogen is spot on. The reason why people are interested in N15 is that it's actually widely used as an estimate of nutrient availability. Nutrient availability is mediated by the microbes that move different levels of isotopes in there. This is actually showing these areas as basically having higher nutrient availability, which is what we would expect from a more recently disturbed forest that's regrown over 25 or 30 years compared to these older forests that have. Another kind of interesting part is, so this is actually just sort of showing all of this and showing that it's related to this logging history and nutrient availability. And this is an interpretation that really helps us understand. And this isn't something that we would have actually seen or even looked for if we hadn't tried to develop this relationship. An interesting other component to it here is that actually you see some variation in here. And if you see, there are differences in nitrogen that are here. Some of those don't show up right here. Some of the variations that we're seeing in these forests are actually due to differences in the understory. There are these ericaceous understory shrubs, a lot of similar types of shrubs that you might have in the northern part of Scotland as well. They have a very different mycorrhizal relationship with the vegetation than when you don't have ericaceous shrubs. And we're seeing in places where there are these understories, which we can't detect or map, we're seeing variations which we suggest might be related to differential nutrient uptake. Okay, scaling. This is where I'm just going to, I really just have one slide here. I wanted to bring something up. I talked about measurements at the leaf level. I've talked about measurements proximal. I've talked about towers. I've actually shown low altitude or mid altitude planes. I've shown a high altitude plane. I haven't shown any orbital. I really would like to see the types of technologies I work with get into space, and maybe it'll happen one day. These all have scales at which measurements are made. This scale right here, and I call it the current big thing, is actually really important, UAVs, because it's an intermediate scale that we can't do with planes. And we OSHA in the US would be all after us if we tried to get up to the sort of levels of 10 to 120 meters. So I just wanted to point out that one of the things that I'm working on, and I don't have any imagery yet to show or measurements even to show from this, but this is going to actually allow us to make all of these linkages across these different scales. And I just want to make the point that it's the measurements at a variety of different scales that allow us to understand the ecosystem. And I showed you that earlier slide, which isn't shown right here, but the measurements of the same thing at different scales aren't all the same. And that's a major area of research. So what's next? I just want to make a plug. This is from my collaborator, John Gammon, that there's a lot of measurements that we can make that can tell us a lot about our ecosystem. I told you how vegetation basically does three things. It does with the light that absorbs. It shunts the light towards photochemistry, which is what I study. It can fluoresce it, or it can quench it through heat dissipation. And measurement of chlorophyll fluorescence is a big area that we can address. And this is some measurements from our collaborative project here. This is just a true color image. This is an image where we derive fluorescence using the fluorescence emission bands from this head wall imaging spectrometer. And the areas that are kind of pinkish are areas that are having higher fluorescence that might be interpreted to have higher amounts of photosynthesis going on. So here I'm showing this again. There are these wavelengths of vegetation absorbs the light in chlorophyll at different wavelengths. It fluoresces it at slightly longer wavelengths. And those might be just 1 or 2% of reflectance, greater than what the ambient reflectance is. But if we can come up with clever methods by which to disentangle the radiance that's from the Earth versus the radiance, the only thing creating fluorescence is going to be the vegetation. Nothing else is going to be creating fluorescence in the vegetative ecosystem. So that leads to the possibility that, once again, we might be able to identify, we might be able to use these hyperspectral measurements at very narrow wavelengths, say around 760 nanometers, to be able to make those types of estimates. It actually takes all types. I've talked about imaging spectroscopy, but LIDAR is a big part of the story. I think that we can get at the heartbeat and lung capacity of ecosystems using spectroscopy, but to get at the total mass of what's there requires something like LIDAR. And I have a student, this is actually Madison, this is an arboretum in Madison, this is one of our many lakes. My office would be somewhere up here. We actually estimate some of the biochemical characteristics here. This is nitrogen from Abrus, this is vegetation skin temperature. My student used multi-temporal LIDAR to estimate vegetation growth. We think that vegetation growth should be proportional to the temperature of the vegetation and nitrogen, which in our area is the main driver. And so we just asked the question, could we predict growth? So this is actually a map of the predicted growth based on actual growth. It's just, this is a back of the envelope type of thing that we did, based on surface temperature and nitrogen, and also taking into consideration whether it's conifer or broadleaf deciduous. Now what I'm showing you here is the map from LIDAR and the predicted map just using Abrus imagery and master thermal imagery. And the places where these images don't line up are places where the forest was managed, where something had been cut or something like that, and they line up. And this is the sort of thing where we actually need to start to take people who do spectroscopy, people who do LIDAR, people who do multi-temporal, multi-spectral imagery, to be able to bring them all together to understand what's happening in an ecosystem. That we can actually use this information here to tell us something about what we might actually want to be able to measure. This is the process, this is the result of the process, and we need both of them. And that's all I have to say. Like I said, there are a bunch of different people, and you know, I'm probably still at this phase. I know Alistair's trying to get to where he's got a drone that will be flying with that, but I have to rely on pigeons at this point. But fancy imagery can take us a long way. These are the types of agencies in the U.S. that fund me, and I am ready to take questions. Because the cardinalized, you know, the light that's being measured at the leaf level gets into the leaf and bounces around, and some of it comes back out, and it's reflecting more. So there are absorption features that are associated with it, but there are also reflectance features that are associated with the milk, the actual way that the chemical looks in it, that its delivery, which is in this latex-like material. So there's another. Alistair, was it? Did we talk about trichomes at some point?
We have talked about trichomes.
Yeah, so there's another thing. Milkweed has very distinctive trichomes, and trichomes change their characteristics too as the plant is perturbed as well. And John has had an interest over a number of years in trying to figure out how we can use spectroscopy to look at the trichomes, the trichome density that's also associated with this.
So we don't have necessarily any ecologists for the trichomes. Trichomes are the little hairs that you get on the surface of the leaves.
Guard the stomates.
But this isn't fully understood. I think one of the things to do is scatter light, shade storm.
Anything else? Yeah. Next one.
All the results and methodology used were based in the US. My question is, could this methodology and study be applied in other parts of the world, other ecosystems?
Anything that's done with a spectrometer can be done anywhere that you can get a spectrometer. And so at some point, what I need to do is actually put a spectrometer on the slide or put a plane on the slide to let you know how the measurement was made. The imaging spectrometers, there are imaging spectrometers that folks have, and so it's really a matter of having an imaging spectrometer that's well characterized. What is it? High plant, which is the one that the Germans fly, has been flown over a variety of areas in the EU. I know that the group, the field spectroscopy facility group, has a plane. I don't know what the spectrometer is.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
High speed.
But even in the U.S., I'm special. This is an expensive instrument to be flown. It's irritating to people because it's expensive to fly. The plane that they fly it on is expensive, and it's the funding that allows me to do it. We're really, really pushing hard to get NASA to launch an imaging spectrometer for civilian purposes to be able to do this sort of stuff. Probably the soonest that data would be widely available will be from NMAP, which is a German imaging spectrometer. It's got about a 30-kilometer swath width, so it's not going to be global. What NASA wants to do is one that's like Landsat, will have a 185-kilometer swath, and will be able to, every 19, 25 days, whatever, image the whole planet. Actually, I lied when I said that NMAP, which is probably going to be 2018 before that comes online. NASA will probably put an imaging spectrometer on the space station within the next couple of years, but it will be limited. You guys will barely make it. If you're below 55 degrees north, you'll barely make it. The space station only goes between 55 degrees north and south, so that's the only area that will be. But then it won't be like a near polar orbit. It'll be going whichever way the space station is going, so there'll be lots of interesting different types of effects. But there's a bunch of people who are working really hard to do this, to put these types of instruments in space, just like they are with LIDAR. And some of it is just trying to get a foothold with the people who make the decisions. Go and show, look at these cool things that you can do that you can't do with anything else. And, oh, by the way, we need to do all of it. Our politicians don't like to do that. Yes?
How much of the spectrum do you use when you're distinguishing between the genetics?
How much of the
spectral information do you reduce it down to?
No. So we treat the spectrum as a vector of information. The methods that we use the entire spectrum except for the water absorption features, depending upon whether we're using imaging spectroscopy or not. We'll avoid the water absorption features. And then we have a variety of multi-dimensional techniques that we use, but it uses the entire spectrum. So for example, the spectral angle, the normalized spectral angle between measurements might be a distance metric that we would use, and it uses in 224 dimensions the spectral angle between different samples. And then you use a statistical analysis, whether it's Schmidt analysis, Mantel test, or something like that, to be able to identify the differences. So this is where I get up on my soapbox, as we say, we need the whole spectrum. The whole spectrum is what gives us the information content. There might be individual wavelengths, like I showed right there, that we know are associated with absorption features that are related to digitoxin or crinitolides. That's useful for that, but it might not be useful for something else, and it also might not be useful for overall water content and other features.
Thank you. Who's all doing the hyperspectral courses here? Right, so actually, we could have done with having this presentation after the course. So what I'll get from Phil is a copy of the presentation, so that during the hyperspectral, I guess there's about a dozen of you. During the course, we'll discuss this in more detail, some of these concepts that Phil has introduced. Okay, Phil.
Right. Yes, I think that's geodrift tag, so unless there are any burning questions, we can save those for some drinks. So do come and join us. So I should say thank you to the volunteers for helping me set up. Thank you to everyone for coming. So, thanks to Phil for a very interesting talk. Thank you again.